Good evening, everybody. Stephane Molyneux from Free Domain, freedomain.com. So, Charlie Kirk and Irina Zarutska are the two topics of what we're going to talk about tonight. Irina Zarutska was killed in August, murdered in August. She was on, I think, a light rail train, and she was stabbed by a crazed, it seems to me, race-hating black guy who muttered later, "I got that white girl." She'd fled the war in Ukraine, and she met her grisly end bleeding out in public transit in the United States. She was much more likely to be attacked in that way than she was to die in the war, that many places in America are worse than a war zone when it comes to fatalities, especially civilian fatalities. The dorm room picture that's been floating around appears to be fake, and I will take my tweet down about that. My apologies. And she did not practice, and this is no shade on her. My God, she shouldn't have to. This is not her fault. She was slaughtered in a blind spot, defenseless position. This has nothing to do with anything negative towards her, but and of course, she probably thought that she had gotten to a safe place away from the war. And I assume she grew up in a non-urban environment and didn't notice or know how dangerous things were. But to be a man is to be constantly aware of threats and dangers. It didn't used to be this way. It really didn't. When I grew up, as I said on X recently, when I grew up in England and Ireland and so on, I never worried about crime, never worried about any of that sort of stuff. As I've said before on the show, shortly before we came to Canada, I was 11, and I'd been roaming around the city on buses and the tube, they call it, subway, since the age of about 4 or 5, just roamed around. I mean, honestly, kids these days, you don't understand what glorious anarchy there was in the childhoods of the past. I mean, one of the reasons why people want to have fewer kids these days is because you got to keep them home. You can't just let them roam. It's dangerous. And yeah, so shortly before we moved to Canada, I was going down to the British War Museum, which I loved to go to. I loved to go to the British Natural Museum, look at the giant blue whale and all the other cool stuff. And I used to go, there was a World War II museum, I don't know if it's still there, out at Hendon. And then there was the Imperial War Museum, or the British War Museum in London. And I went down there with some friends, and we were held at knife point by three black youths and stripped of our money. And what was wild to me about that, I hadn't really had much exposure to black people before. My best friend in boarding school was actually an Indian boy, the only Indian boy in the whole school. But I remember them being very merry. They found it very funny. They found it engaging and enjoyable. And we went to the police, but unfortunately, because we were going to leave for Canada, we couldn't do anything further from a legal standpoint. And I wonder now, sort of thinking back on it, my mother spent a lot of time in South Africa, and I wonder if she was moving us for reasons of concern or safety, something like that. It's hard to know. Hard to know. So to be a man, and I'm sure this is true for some women, is to just be in a constant state of threat assessment, especially these days, just threat assessment. Where could the threats be coming from? The fight or flight, it evolves from hunter stuff and war stuff and all of the stuff that men evolved. And ladies, I mean, you're going to have to do it. You have to do it. Something seems sketchy, trust your instincts and stay away. Stay away. Trust your instincts. We have a gut brain. We have neurons piled up by the yin and yang in our bellies, in our gut. The gut instinct is essential for your survival. If something seems sketchy, if you're worried, don't be concerned about causing offense. Don't be concerned about harming relations. Just get safe. Because that's where we are. That's where we are. It's not by accident. That's the way we are. Stay safe. Something seems sketchy. Get off the bus, assuming it's safe. Leave the mall, move aside, move away, cross the street, go into a store, talk to a security guard, talk to a cop. Anything. In a sketchy situation, or anything potentially sketchy, if you can't get off the bus, at least go up and stand by the bus driver. And keep your head on a swivel. That's life. It's where we are. It is, of course, fascinating and mildly upsetting, I suppose, that one pretty slender young Ukrainian girl gets murdered, appalling and horrifying and horrible, and people lose their minds. And yet, hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian and Russian men are being slaughtered in a war. And the purpose of the war appears to just be to continue. To just continue and throw as many Ukrainians and Christians into the meat grinder of war for profit and power as humanly possible. And these are men who are, I'm sure you've seen the videos, they're dragged and grabbed off the street, thrown into the front lines, I don't think with an excess of training. One woman gets killed. Everybody loses their mind. Hundreds of thousands of men get killed. And where were the feminists? Where were all the people with the Ukrainian flags in their bio? Really care about refugees, really care about Ukrainians, really care about women. Nothing and nowhere. And I posted on X, Irina Zarutska, just do a search for people's timeline. They claim to care about this, that, or the other. If they haven't texted or posted about that, dismissed, dismissed, dismissed. Was it 2015? I think almost 10. I think it would be 10 years ago in December, if memory serves me right, when I published The Truth About Crime. You can still find it on fdrpodcast.com, which has got the kind of information that keeps people alive. I suggest you watch it. I suggest you absorb it and stay safe as best you can in these troubled times. It's very sad. It's very sad. It is a wild thing to have this video evidence now that has never really been before in history. I mean, there was a Zapruder film and so on. And I remember a history teacher in grade. I took a summer school course. I took two summer school courses in grade 11 just so I could get out of the prison of government schools a semester early. And I remember my history teacher brought in an expert on the Kennedy assassination. So you could see that, but not live, not real time, not with analysis in the moment. And now you can see, oh God, heart-wrenching. I mean, especially for fathers of daughters, but it's heart-wrenching to see poor Irina getting slashed and just being frightened and not knowing she was already dead and living for a minute or two, just bleeding out. Not knowing that she was already dead. And you could see her dressing down as a very beautiful woman with a great figure, and you could see her dressing down. Worked at a pizza place, the little hat that she wore to the pizza place next to her, on her phone. I don't know if she had headphones in, but just dead. And the other people on the train or the subway just getting away, not helping. That's where we are. That's where we are. And she thought she'd come to a safe place. And I couldn't help but wonder, and this, you know, the last thing I really want to do is make any of this about me, but I want to tell you sort of where I come from this perspective, like why I have this perspective. So when I was a kid, every penny was essential. Every penny was essential. We faced eviction notices, threatened to be tossed out into the snow. I remember there was a sign on the superintendent's door in the building that I grew up in. Rent checks must be certified after the 5th of each month. Now, for those of you who were younger, that means that you had to take your rent check to the bank and have them certify and freeze the funds in the check so that when you handed it over, they could cash it knowing it wasn't going to be bounced. It wasn't going to be NSF, non-sufficient funds. And if you've ever been in a situation of dire poverty, and I mean, it wasn't dire poverty, but I mean, when I was a student, I was living on $600 a month, $650 a month, all in. I didn't go to a dentist for like 10 years. And if you've ever been in a situation where pennies count, where the only food that you can eat has to be from a dented can, where you just live on tap water and Spam. If you've ever been in that sort of Raskolnikov, Dostoevskian kind of situation where pennies count, I remember I would have friends over and there'd be maybe a little bit of pop and I'd have to cram all of the glasses full of ice to make it. And they'd be like, hey man, why is this all ice? And I'm like, I can't say. That's one of the reasons I got my first job when I was 10 and worked ever since. And at one time in high school, I've been paying my own bills since I was 15. And one time in high school, I had three jobs. And I loved working in restaurants because I could at least eat there. And, you know, hanging around friends' places, hoping that there's some food for you. I remember one of the few times I felt full as a child, as hungry as a child, a lot. And one of the few times I felt full as a child, because there was even food shortages in the 70s when I was in boarding school. I remember a friend of mine, he later died in a horrible motorcycle accident, but his mother took us to, Ponderosa, I think it was, where it was all you could eat. It's the first time I tasted chickpeas, and I went full hog. I remember feeling full, finally. I remember being at a McDonald's party for a friend of mine, you know, and everybody was so stuffed. And I remember his mom saying, okay, does anybody want anything else? And I'm like, yeah, I could do a fillet of fish. Just, you know, you want to bulk up. You want to feed up because you don't, and your body doesn't know. So anyway, I don't want to sort of get into a whole thing about my Dickensian childhood. But what I do want to say is this murderer of Irina Zarutska, how was he paying his bills? It was a constant fascination with me. Because again, if you've been really poor, you know, every dollar, every dime helps and counts. So how was he paying his bills? The woman who was the judge, I didn't even know this. Apparently you could be a judge without a law degree. Be a judge without a law degree. I think she was sending people to a rehab facility that she part owned or something, like wild stuff. But how was he paying his bills? How was he living? Was he homeless? How did he eat? How did he get on the train? Some people saying, oh, it's an honor system train and blah, blah, blah. But it was a constant issue for me, covering rent, covering food, getting enough to drink. It mattered how much people tipped me, because this is back in the day, everybody paid cash, and sometimes I would give great service because I needed to pay rent. And then when I was in university, I lived in the same room with a guy. We lived in the same room. I was that poor. So how is this guy? And now, as a worker, as a taxpayer, and Irina's mother said that she got a job the moment she got her visa. The moment she got her work visa, she got a job. Her murderer, how was he living? Was it government money? Was Irina being forced to fund the guy who murdered her? I don't know. The guy had been arrested 14 times. Even his own mother, the murderer's own mother, was like, please do something. Don't leave him out on the streets. I read reports that said his brother or his half-brother 13 years ago murdered a white man in a unprovoked, well, it's unprovoked. There's no provocation to kill someone except in an extremity of self-defense. No provocation. I was reading there was a 14-year-old white boy whose skull was caved in by a classmate because apparently he made a joke and called someone my boy. No picture, so you know. No picture, so you know. Treat criminals, be nice to criminals. It does not work. You know, empathy requires 13 separate parts of the brain to be wired up from birth onwards. You cannot regrow it later. You can't fix it later. There are these things called mirror neurons. And, you know, here's a test. Here's a test. I'm not any kind of psychologist, psychiatrist, or doctor. I ain't no doctor with degree, but I will tell you my completely rank amateur way of figuring out if someone has mirror neurons. What you do is you show them, and there are endless videos of this online, you show them a man taking a hard shot to the groin. A golf ball, a frisbee, a football, taking a hard shot to the groin. And if they go, ooh, that's mirror neurons. If they laugh, no mirror neurons. In my, obviously, again, completely amateur, I can't watch those videos. Because they hurt. And look at those videos and they hurt. I feel them. Oh. I don't know how common that is, but looking around the world today, doesn't seem to be common really at all to have these mirror neurons which allow you to feel what someone else feels. But that requires, I think, that you have an inner dialogue, that you have a philosophical gut-brain connection between yourself and other human beings, basic empathy, what the other person wants, I want, what they feel, I could feel, they're just like me, but separate in space. How common is that these days? Well, I won't kill someone because I don't want to be killed. I won't rob from someone because I wouldn't like to be robbed from. I won't punch someone because I don't like to get punched. Or I won't shoot a conservative speaker in the fucking neck while he's trying to reason with people. Because I wouldn't like to be shot in the fucking neck when I'm trying to reason with people. That's what I'm talking about. Mirror neurons, basic empathy, seems to be a vanishingly scarce resource these days. And it's not that hard to whip up these kinds of atrocities, really. I mean, I've been talking about this for like, 40 years, 30 years, 20 years as a public figure. All you do is you create a moral category of pure evil, let's say Nazi. And then you say that if we don't harm the Nazis, the worst conceivable thing in the world will happen. Civilization will end. And then you just whip people's hatred up to this category, and then you start feeding people into this category until a crazy person attacks them. It's not that hard. It's not that complicated. This is the Rwandan thing. You just refer to people, you dehumanize people, refer to them as cockroaches or Nazis or white supremacists, or you just keep applying labels that are like targeting devices. You know, those targeting devices where drones will paint a particular area with a laser tag and then it's tagging people. You're just tagging people in the media's. I'm sure they have other jobs than this, but I can't quite remember what they are at the moment. And you just keep tagging people. And that's the ultimate hate speech, really. It's tagging people with these. You charge up these negative labels with immense contempt and hatred, and then you just paint people with these labels until a crazy person thinks they're doing God's great work through violence. And I always remember Alger Hiss, oddly enough, in this context, and I won't get into the whole history about this, but Alger Hiss was a pretty terrible guy, and he went to jail, I think it was for perjury. And when he got out, he was feted. Come to the dinner party, he's a cool guy. I'm sure this, I mean, this has happened with Luigi Mangione, I think his name was, the shooter of the Health Corporation CEO. It happens with the worship of criminals. The left generally never runs across a vile and violent criminal that they can't find some way to lionize, of course. I mean, this is back to the George Floyd issue. Austin Metcalf, that video still hasn't been released. It's been, 4 months now? Gotta be bad. And, of course, the left is constantly saying that the cops are bigoted and terrible and wrong and bad and evil, and they gotta be camered up, they gotta be mic'd up. Well, I guess people are seeing now some of what the cops have to deal with. And now they're trying to shut down some video cameras that are there to protect people. Which brings us to the appalling story of Charlie Kirk. So I didn't know Charlie. I met him, I think, once or twice. We shared a stage at a speaking event in St. Louis shortly after I was deplatformed in 2020. Where I spoke about the temptations of evil that Jesus faced. And this was, I guess he was in his early mid-20s. He died today, was murdered today at the age of 31. He's got a wife and two daughters. And he was the passionate, intense, focused. And Charlie had a real positive, humorous, humble benevolence to him. He had a masterful grasp of facts and details. My brain doesn't work that way, so I just, you know, bow down in admiration to people who can just reel off. Ann Coulter's like that, Megyn Kelly is like that, just have this precision of details, names, facts, principles. Well, principles I can do, but the other ones are, I'm very impressed by that. I have to double check everything. And I'm very, very impressed by that. And he went around America talking at campuses, trying to reason with people, arguing, debating. As in, we can talk about it. And as he repeatedly said, where words end is where the violence begins. And this is, of course, not my original idea, but goes back to one of the original thoughts of philosophy. That we reason together so we don't fucking kill each other. Somebody's got to win. And for someone to win, others have to lose. Now we either win or lose through debate, or we win or lose through killing each other. There's really not much else, or the threat thereof. It's all we have. Reason, violence, that's it. There is no third choice, there is no third option. And Charlie, to his, I guess now, eternal credit, believed in reason, believed in debate, believed in conversations. Now, it's boring and not even worth anything to say, well, he and I didn't agree on everything, because people say that sort of stuff, and it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Charlie was bringing the power of conversation to American and therefore Western political discourse. Let us reason together, saith the Lord. And Charlie obeyed that divine commandment. He sat down and he reasoned. He gave people the mics. He gave passionate, empowered speeches. He was humble in that people said, hey man, you don't even have a college degree. To which Charlie would reply, then it should be easy to beat me. He waded in with great courage to 95% of the contentious issues of the day. There were a few he avoided. I'm not going to complain about that. Anybody with more sense than God gives a goose has certain topics they step around. But it took a lot of courage to be out there. It took a lot of courage to be out there. And he did it. With a wife, with children, with a great, grave, and desperate hope that we could keep the S off words. I guess the second S off words. It's words or swords. Words or swords. That's all we have. We either gracefully concede to reason and evidence, or from a rooftop. I don't know that there's anything else. I've never seen anything else. And those of us with some talent at provoking debate, at bringing reason and evidence, at interviewing, at creating charts and PowerPoints, and desperately trying to avert this unrushing Stanley Kubrick tide of blood that emerges when words are blown apart with long-range sniper rifles, we have been very desperate to avert the violence that is at war with words. People who are bad at debating, people who aren't particularly smart, people who can't defend their position, people whose positions are denied by reason and evidence, get violent, get aggressive. Of course. What else are they supposed to do? Lose? Well, if you're mature, you realize that there's no losing in a debate. I have been corrected countless times over the course of what I've done. And I have gained wisdom, facts, truth, and the honor of conceding to reason and evidence every single time. If you're arguing with a doctor, saying, oh, I do have a terrible infection, but I don't need any antibiotics, you're wrong. And the doctor convinces you, have you lost? No! You're not dead! You win! When you submit to reason and evidence. Own your pathetic satanic ego loses, which it should. The desire to be right at all costs is one of the greatest roots of evil, the desire for the unearned, whether it's material or victory in a debate. Have the grace and wisdom and maturity and humanity to concede defeat when you're wrong, so that the world wins thereby, and the world gets to see an example of somebody who's intelligent saying, or it's even more important if they're not particularly intelligent, saying, that's a great point. I think you're right. Yeah, you're right. Like, I was talking today because before hearing the appalling news of Charlie Crook's murder, and, you know, fingers crossed, man, I watched that video. Oh, my God. Oh. Right through the neck. And the blood, the volume of blood. I'm no doctor, but I didn't see how he could make it. And the fact that he slumped over right away, right? You've got these two veins on your spine, right? Was it the carotid that brings the blood to your brain and then the jugular that takes it away? And if those get compromised, man, you're losing a liter or two of blood every minute. And it's rough, man, because even if they can keep your body alive, if your brain is starved of oxygen, like 30 seconds, it starts to go dark. And the fact that he slumped over and the volume of blood. When he was trying to reason. When he was trying to avoid a society forcing hemlock down people's throats because he wanted to debate. But people who can't win with words turn to swords. People who can't win with ballots turn to bullets. And he is he's a martyr. He's a martyr in the old battle between civilized discourse and psycho-fucking violence. He is a martyr to the ancient divide that humanity has, which is we talk or we murder. There is an infinity of human desires. There is a very much finity or finite level of resources. Everybody wants everything. We only have so much. How does it get distributed? How does it get shared? How does it get generated? How does it get transferred? How do people pay their rent, their food? How? Everybody wants to live in a giant mansion and have infinity buffets, but we can't have that. Everybody wants to be right. Everybody wants to get their way, but we can't have that because people's wills and desires and thirsts conflict all the time. All the time. Human society is in an absolutely continuous process of disagreement. You want to ask a girl out? She says no. Look, you disagree. You want to get a job? They say no. Oh, look, you disagree. You want lunch? Oh, shoot, I forgot my wallet. You disagree. You want lunch for free? They want to charge you. Hell, you're walking down the street. Somebody's in your way and you do that little shuffle and a little boogaloo where you have to figure out can't walk through each other. You disagree. Left, right. I wanted people to follow me to new platforms. In fact, I wanted more people to follow me. Gee, wouldn't it have been great for philosophy if my deplatforming had led to the Streisand effect of more and more people being interested in philosophy? I wanted people to follow me to new platforms. They disagreed. And they chose to stay and listen to others. Fine. We absolutely have to have the right to disagree. Or we turn to violence. Who gets the girl? Who gets the young woman? You want it? Maybe she doesn't want anyone, but if there's a bunch of guys, so she's very pretty and they want to date her, who gets her? Well, either she gets to review men's offers and choose one or none of them. Or there's some horrible universe wherein some evil Genghis Khan scoops her on the back of his horse and rides her to Rape Mountain. But in order to productively disagree, it's like in order to productively play chess, you have to obey the fucking rules. And the rules are, you talk about stuff and you don't initiate the use of force. Because if you do, there's no civilization left. I don't think that the people who use violence, I don't think that they have, it seems like even the remotest clue, how delicate and sensitive to violence the infrastructure of society is. Why do farmers grow all of this excess food? You know, I was driving in Ontario, north of the city, a week or two ago. Endless fields of wheat, corn, soybeans. Just goes on and on. Like a Buzz haircut from Top Gun. Why are they doing that? It's way more food than they need. Well, so they can trade things with people in the city. You go and get gas. Why is there gas there? Why is there gas there? Because you don't steal it. Because if everyone stole the gas, there'd be no gas stations. There'd be no cars. With no cars, there are no cities. With no cities, there's mass starvation, violence, rioting, looting. Everything that we have, everything that keeps us alive, everything that allows for this conversation, requires a delicate process of negotiation. The guys who run the gas stations want to pay less for the gas. The guys who sell the gas want to charge more for the gas, and they come to some reasoned compromise where the gas station guys say, hey, we're not just going to hijack the gas truck because we're going to pay. And the gas companies don't say, we're just not going to. We're going to take your money, run giggling off into the woods. Dance among the barleycorn, corn and cashew checks, and never deliver it. The gas, it is all proposal, negotiation, compromise, and acceptance. That's all. That's what, I mean, that is the food and fuel and fucking oxygen that keeps 80 to 90% of people in the West alive. There's an old story about Frank Sinatra, of course, the great Italian-American singer and bandleader. He was so skilled in music that he could be full orchestra, 100 pieces, and he could hear one note, one bum note. Oh, I think we got a little stranger here, he would say. He could hear one bum note in the third bassoon 50 meters away. And he wouldn't record. Hey, I'll start again. I can't have a bum note in there. People are kept alive. I mean, this is end of the Roman Empire stuff, right? People are kept alive in cities because we reason with each other, we negotiate with each other, and we don't use violence. That's the only thing that keeps, and I swear, it is a death wish to want to use violence in what remains a relatively civilized society, to want to shoot people, to want to stab people, to want to threaten people. And even the threat of violence is very powerful. I mean, you all know this, when I was speaking and touring, death threats, bomb threats, I needed security, been hunted through cities, crazy stuff, just for having an opinion or an argument or a perspective or data that people don't like. Now, we used to try and keep dumb, violent people away from social discourse by having, you know, very high entrance requirements for universities and so on, so that they could be civilized places of discourse for the most part. But that's all gone by the wayside because equity. So people who use violence, who gun down, a relatively mild Socratic reasoner like Charlie Kirk, they shoot Charlie Kirk and they say, Violence, not reason, is how we decide stuff. Violence. I can't debate him. I can't out-argue him. I can't disprove his arguments. So I'll blow his fucking head off. So they shoot Charlie Kirk, and what they're really shooting is our capacity to reason with each other, our capacity to negotiate, which is our capacity to not die. As a thought experiment, imagine how many farmers would it take being hijacked and killed when they're trying to drive their produce into a town for farmers to say, whoa, a little too dangerous to go into town. I think I'll just keep my food here. An attack on the farmers is actually an attack on the millions and millions and millions of people who live in cities. Shooting Charlie Kirk is like shooting an adamantine statue, which causes the bullets to multiply by 10 million and go out into the general population. When we shoot people we disagree with, we are saying that it is violence, not reason, that will resolve social disputes, which means the cities are going to fucking die. Because if we can't negotiate, if we can't reason, if we can't accept things we don't want, the economy collapses, the farmers stay home, and everybody dies. The stakes are that high. This is one of the reasons why I put my neck literally on the chopping block many times, to bring forward this message of peace and reason. So I will take your questions and your comments, but there's one other thing that I want to say, and I appreciate your patience as I unpack my thoughts and feelings, hopefully in a way that is productive and helpful for you, for the world as a whole. I've made the case before. Maybe it's seemed kind of theoretical to you. I promise you, from the bone marrow of my soul's spine, I promise you, this is not theoretical. It never was, but I hope it's vivid now. I'm going to tell you how to survive the world that is trying to be built on blood. How to prevent it, how to prevent those foundations from being assembled. I call it the gleam. You could call it anything that you want. It's the gleam. It's that little satanic, sadistic gleam. And you can see it. I mean, it's all over Blue Sky and other places. You can see it on X. You could see it with the murder of Irina Zarudska. You could see it with the murder of Charlie Kirk. It's a little gleam. You sit down with some sketchy family members, some sketchy friends or whatever, and this topic comes up. There's that little gleam. Ooh. Are people saying horrible things like, I hope the bullet that hit Charlie Kirk had a good day. Horrible people say, right? Or when they say, when they quote Charlie Kirk as saying, well, there's a certain amount of gun deaths that are going to have to be accepted in order to have the Second Amendment. Ah, right. Now people always try and use your words against you in an evil manner. It's very sadistic. And I could recite countless examples from my inbox, but I won't bother because let's make this about the victims of the last while. It's the gleam. It's the gleam. So you talk about Irina Zarudska, and there's a little gleam. You talk about Charlie Kirk. Well, he was divisive. Little gleam. That's the germ seed of Great Evil. Gleam. They're free to have it. You're free to be a sick little sadistic asshole who gets a little gleam, a little thrill, a little joy. Well, you know, Charlie Kirk did say some pretty controversial things. Controversial until about 8 minutes ago. There's a gleam. This is why, while telling people to be situationally aware, the last thing I want to do is blame poor Irina Zarudska for being slaughtered. It's the gleam.
Well, yes, but...
Look out for that shit, brothers and sisters. Look out for that shit. I am deadly serious about this. You know, I wrote this on X years and years ago. 100 million people slaughtered by communism in the 20th century alone.
Yeah, but...
Total sociopath. Total sociopath. Look at that gleam. Look out for that gleam. That little smug, self-satisfied, well, but, you know... Blah, 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 blah. Socioeconomic factors and slavery and... He was controversial. Look out for anyone who justifies any of this sick violence. Anyone. They will fuck your life up like you would not believe. And I'll tell you this, if you are surrounded by people who've got that little gleam, you're surrounded by people like that. You are surrounded by a fiery mode of sadism, which no decent soul will cross. You will be locked in. Like Sartre's, pas de sortie, no exit. You will be locked in a dungeon, in a hellscape, in a soulless prison of suggestible sadism. You will be locked in for the rest of your life. Because if you're surrounded by people who've got their little gleam, a little, well, but, you know, well, good people, we smell that. We smell that. You know, like a 20-day raccoon dead under the floorboards. Then we avoid. We avoid. I haven't, like in my own personal life, I wouldn't say blessed, but I mean, I've earned it, but I'm very pleased and happy to be surrounded by people who are, you know, genuinely good people. They fight the good fight. We support each other. And I have, I mean, a wonderful, immensely treasured wife and friends and family. There's no gleam. It's all just, ugh, this is vile. There's no, but, well, you know, he could have avoided this topic, or he's just being so provocative there, or... Talk to people in your life about these murders. Scan like hell for that gleam.
Well, you know, but again...
Anything but a full-throated horror at and rejection of this kind of violence should be. And I would absolutely recommend you take this approach, both for morality and for your own safety and happiness. Anybody who has the glee, or the pause, or the well, or the caveats, or the yes buts, anybody has that around, get them the fuck out of your life. I can't command anything, obviously. I'm just making the case. Anybody who's like, well, but, you know,
Eject! Eject!
My God. How could you have these glass-eyed, sneaky sadists in your midst? I tell you, I haven't seen the gleam, gosh, how long it's been since I've looked at someone, not someone I meet with or debate with or whatever. I've certainly seen it in debate opponents. But in terms of seeing that yes, but gleam, it's like the sunlight goes in through the eyeballs, bounces off a block of ice in place of a heart and just reflects back through the sinuses. Just this little gleam in the eyes. It's a warning. It's a warning. Clear sign of incipient predation. I'm getting old. I'll be, in 2 weeks, I'll be 59. That gleam, when did I last see it? Early 30s? Yeah, I think early 30s. I remember seeing that gleam with someone. This is back in 03, the invasion of Iraq. And I was saying, you know, that they're not going to find him. He's like, you know, they'll find the WMDs. It'll be 5 years, 10 years. They're going to find the man. And it was just this gleam. I like watching war. Death. I haven't seen that gleam in decades in person because I find it so soul-curdlingly repulsive that I don't see the gleam because people don't want to see my narrowed eyes in response to this shitty little sadistic gleam that they have. Well, he was kind of inflammatory, and he knew what he was doing, and there were risks. Blah, blah, blah. Oh! Blah! I'm telling you, man, steer the fuck clear. I don't know how to make it clearer. Don't have people like that in your life. They will fuck you up one way or another, and they will certainly keep good people away from you and be, oh, I can't find any good people. It's like, well, yeah, because their laser gleams are keeping everyone away. People who make excuses for violence will fuck you up. They're just NPC finger puppets of the darkest impulses in our natures. So, that's where we're at. I'm happy to take questions or comments. All right. Yeah, Joseph, you're back. If you would like to say something.
Yeah. You hear me?
Apologies. Yes, go ahead.
So I just want to bring it back to the Charlie Kirk thing.
Yeah.
You know, when I say in this country, I'm talking United States of America. Just where do you think this goes now? You know, I know that's a very general question, but you mentioned the gleam in people's eyes. And, you know, in this country, you know, something just feels different about this. You know, I know recently was the other poor woman on the Boston, North Carolina, but something about Charlie Kirk, maybe it's because he's specifically a politician, just feels different.
He's not a politician, but he's definitely a political activist or advocate or something like that.
Right. So I guess my question is just, you know, does it get to a point where the gleam is too much and people just stop having his, you know, what he stood for, or...
Sorry, you
know,
people, you cut out there for a second. You said, where the gleam gets too much and something.
Is this the point where, you know, people, whether gradually or suddenly, stop trying to have civil discourse?
Well, you can't have civil discourse with people who don't listen to reason. And so what is, as in, whatever you feed, you get more of, and whatever you starve, metaphorically, you get less of. So people need to, there's a dividing line, and I'm sorry that it goes through families, and I'm sorry that it goes through friendships. I really am. I wish it weren't the case. I've certainly tried to bring as much reason to the world, I think, as humanly possible. Maximum reason has always been my driving force, but you gotta make your choice. You gotta make your choice. Are you going to support those who support violence or not? And if you're going to support those who support violence, hey, let's break bread together. We just won't talk about these things. I don't want to see that gleam, so I'm not going to bring up political terrorism. I don't want to see the look in people's eyes their slavering hunger for more blood. I don't want to see that. So we'll just talk about sports ball, and we'll talk about the weather, and we'll talk about Aunt Jenny's goiter, and we'll avoid any real topics of moral import or depth. And so the world is made by what we accept. I mean, if you're Brad Pitt and you say, I'm going to charge $50 to be in your movie, you get $50. Because he's willing to accept that. You're going to go do a movie, right? Okay. So the world is made by what you accept. I got a great wife because I wouldn't accept less. If you're negotiating for salary, if you're trying to get a friend or some girl to date you, if you go for some, you know, trashy girl who's broken and easy, then that's what you'll get, because that's what you'll accept. So I'm going to make this completely about me. I'm unabashedly. I think it's helpful for other people, but I'll make it completely about me. My entire purpose here is to die with a clean conscience. To die with a clean conscience is to live forever. I must die with a clean conscience. So what that means is that I'm telling people the world is defined by what you accept. If you accept shitty sadists in your life, the world will get shittier and more sadistic. If you support them, if you break bread with them, if you go to their children's recitals, if you just consort with the cruel, the world will get more cruel. If you don't consort with the cruel, the world will get less cruel. Because cruel people only respond to incentives, not virtues. And we're going to need, the good people need to huddle together, and we need to keep peacefully, reasonably, through voluntary choice and ostracism, we need to keep the bad people at bay. So where does it go? I don't know, because I don't know how many people will listen to and actually act on the case that I'm putting forward. It's a biblical case. Do not consort with evil is foundational to Christianity. I don't know why people don't do it. I don't understand why people who hold the peril of their mortal souls in an immortal sphere dependent upon not consorting with evil and then go and consort with evil. I don't understand. I don't know why. Maybe people just don't really believe in heaven or hell or God or Jesus or the final destinations of their flung souls. I don't know why. I don't believe in heaven or hell, but I don't consort with evildoers. I won't break bread with them. I won't hire them. I won't fund them. I won't go to their stores. I won't economically interact with them as best I can. I see people I don't like in a business, I never go back. I see people I like in a business, I give them my business. So where does it go from here? Wherever people choose to go. But here's the thing. I got to make the case as clearly and passionately as humanly possible so that if the world goes to hell, my conscience is clean. And honestly, my conscience is very, very important to me. My conscience is the difference between living in heaven, where I live, or living in hell, which is where most people live. You can go back to a speech I gave, in case you think this is anything new. Libertopia 2011. My daughter was 18 months. The great Dick Gregory introduced me, and I gave this exact speech. Shun evil. Give them some time to come around, makes a case. Shun evil. Almost 15 years ago. It's the same message. Now, some people will listen, some people won't. Where does the world go? I don't know, because there's free will. All I can control is the clarity, effectiveness, directness, and passion with which I communicate an essential message called support, virtue, and shun evil. What people do with that? Out of my hands. This is people's choices on hearing virtuous arguments have no effect on my conscience. None. No effect on my conscience. If you say to some guy, there's a cliff ahead. Stop. He's running. He's looking back. He's catching a frisbee or a football. There's a cliff. And he decides to keep running. That's sad. But it's no effect on your conscience. Now, if you see the guy running and don't say anything, then that has an effect on your conscience. You've participated in him being harmed or killed. But raising my enlightenment thunderclap of reason and evidence as high and as wide on the rooftop of the world as humanly possible is all I can do. All I can do is make the case. It's up to the jury then to decide. And so far, I'm happy, content, and satisfied with the case that I've made. So where does the world go? Wherever people choose to go. And if you settle for supporting violence, the world gets more violent. And I will stroll out of this veil of tears, not looking back at all. All right. Let us go on. Dark N. Dark N. Does indifference result in a ban also? What if you don't believe in evil in absolute terms? I won't be around amoral people. I mean, my God. Because there's nobody, nobody's functionally incapable. No sane human being is capable of being indifferent to good or evil. All right, Dark Nimbus, if you wanted to bring us your thoughts, I'm happy to hear. Well, aren't we having not much luck? All right, I'll give it another second. Otherwise, we can do an early show. And, he's vanished. I know he's trying to come back. Man, get your text straight, people. It's not that complicated. All right, both Dark and Noah. Yes, no, maybe. Well, I'm going to close off here in my thoughts and great and deep compassion with Charlie Kirk's family, Irina Zarutska's family, the sorrow at the savagery they have faced is almost without calculation in the heart and mind and soul of the world. Big, massive, deep sympathies, thoughts, hugs, compassion to people who are suffering. And these are the two that we know of. Of course, there are countless more over the last few decades, over 100,000. And all we can do is continue to try to do good in a darkening world. And at least with the internet, of course, at least what has happened is that people can no longer claim the veil of ignorance. You've seen the savage attacks. You've seen blood, the choking, the sobbing, the screaming. You can see it all. Don't look away. Don't look away. This is the reality of violence. The reality of violence is a girl bubbling out her last breath on the dirty floor of a train. The reality of violence is Charlie Kirk nobly speaking words before a panoply of gathering orcs and lead going through his windpipe. And dying in a pool of his own blood. That is the world that is being summoned by the gleams. The gleams are an invitation to the darkest aspects of human nature to take front and center and take us back to a dark age. And those who are good at violence are forever at war with those who are good at reason. And an amazing opportunity has been given to the reasoners in the form of the internet to show the reality of the violence being summoned by the gleams in people's eyes, and to communicate with as much peace, reason, passion, and purpose as possible. The stark choice that humanity faces. Which way? Western man. Most of the rest of the world has already chosen its path. We still have that choice before us. Reason or violence. I will do everything in my power to promote reason, negotiation, discourse, debate, dialogue. But you see that gleam? Get the fuck out.